If you're old enough to remember what you ate in, say, the early 90s, you might recall that avocados were not an ingredient you expected to find everywhere. Sure, maybe your favorite Tex-Mex place served guacamole, but sliced avocado wasn't available on top of every sandwich or omelet. And avocado toast, seriously, millennials, was not even a thing. The insatiable American appetite for these creamy fruits is a recent development, and it's had some deeply unsavory effects on communities of growers south of the border. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The explosion in demand for avocados has made them a huge commodity in Mexico, where cartels are poised to seize any industry that can be exploited for cash. Cartels bring violence, and their demand for ever greater production has caused major damage to avocado-growing regions and their water supplies. Today, we're going to talk about a community that has fought to stay out of the fray by ejecting their old leaders, banning avocados, and enforcing the new rules at gunpoint. Alexander Salmon is a contributor to Harper's Magazine, which published his article, Forbidden Fruit. Alexander, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
I do want to start with a bit of the history here. It's not my imagination that avocados were not an American obsession for most of the 20th century, right? They were not, like, impossible to buy, but they were also not something everybody could expect in any decent grocery store.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So there were many attempts to get it to take off. The sort of marketing budget for the avocado throughout the course of the 20th century is gigantic, but a ton of failed starts. There were attempts to market it as like a Mediterranean salad fixture. There were attempts to make it into something more like a sweet, a sort of sweet adjacent delicacy. But for the most part, Americans had no appetite for the fruit. It's obviously one of the stranger fruits you can buy. And it was, yeah, in no meaningful way, part of the American culinary spread across grocery stores, restaurants, fast food, brunch, et cetera.
And those marketing efforts happened because there were avocado growers in California. How did that place establish itself or try to as an avocado producing region?
Yeah, the backstory to me on this is so interesting, and it's a very long backstory that really kind of goes all the way back to the beginning of the settling of California as a state. So, in a lot of ways, the establishment of California was obviously really based on this extractivist logic that there was wealth in the ground, that there was money in the ground, and if you bought a slice of land, you could tap that wealth and pull it up. So, you know, that's what happened in the gold rush. It happened in California's oil rush. And then, of course, eventually it happened with water. And so land speculators and railroad companies who were making a ton of money selling real estate in California, would tell wide-eyed buyers basically that they could pay down their mortgage on the just based on the incredible wealth that was beneath the surface of the land with this water. And so we saw this first with the citrus craze in California, which was, you know, a big push in Los Angeles to sell land based on the notion you could hit it rich growing oranges in your backyard. And then after that, the second wave of that was really based on avocados. And so this was something that was centered largely in Southern California and San Diego County specifically, a huge marketing push. And I think rightfully people would say a huge marketing gimmick to juice the price of land in Southern California and to make record profits for land speculators.
So Southern California farmers sent representatives to the Mexican state of Michoacán to learn from growers there. What were the big takeaways from those trips?
Yeah, so in the 1970s, they start sending down these missions basically for purposes of research and everything else, which happens basically because the avocado industry is a total failure for the first 50 years of its existence, at least in the United States. There was no real history of growing this fruit at scale, so no one knew how to do that, which is one problem. The other problem was that, of course, nobody wanted to eat the fruit. Because it was so unfamiliar and has such a strange taste and texture. And so there was basically money being constantly pumped into advertising, into research, to try to make this a viable enterprise, which, you know, is something that it wasn't really for the first five decades. that it existed in California as an agricultural activity. And yeah, in the 1970s, this group sends a dispatch down to Mexico to figure out basically what's wrong, how growing techniques could be imported, but also really what catches their eye is just the water supply. So in the area that they travel to is an area where there is an exceptional amount of rainfall and groundwater and abundant sort of water resources to grow the fruit, which is critical because it's an insanely water intensive enterprise. And in Southern California, which is obviously a desert, it's a terrible match. But they in the state of Michoacán in central Mexico, they grow it. It's a more natural fit. And I think the sort of primary source documentation from that period shows them marveling at the amount of available water and seeing that, you know, this might be a viable crop in a different climate.
So avocados did so well in Michoacán that some U.S. growers started investing in the region, even though they were initially not able to legally export Mexican avocados to the U.S. What did NAFTA do for Mexican avocado growers?
Yeah, it's an incredible sort of back and forth, because now if you read trade documents or sort of trade publications, you'll see the avocado referred to as NAFTA's shining star, the scion or the a cipher of free trade. But when NAFTA was first passed, actually, avocados grown in Mexico were still forbidden from being imported to the U.S. They were not allowed to be sold stateside. And that was a protection that had been in place basically since the 19-teens to protect, avocado growers in California. These recent land purchasers would be, sort of would be yeoman farmers. In the 90s, NAFTA is passed initially. Avocados are still forbidden from being imported. But as the 90s sort of wear on, there actually is a big fight over what to do about this, because water in California is so expensive that actually it doesn't even make sense for the growers in California to keep selling and growing in the state. So both the combination of investment in Mexico and the exigencies of drought conditions in California make it such that by the late 90s, there's an agreement in place to allow only one state in Mexico, only the state of Michoacán, to grow and export avocados to the U.S. And that's phased in over a number of years and is eventually sort of commonplace. It's allowed for Mexican avocados from Michoacán to be sold in all 50 states by the 2000s.
So yeah, if we buy or eat an avocado this week, it probably comes from Michoacán. Is that right? At least the odds are that it comes from there?
Yes, extremely likely. It's something like between 8 and 9 out of every 10 avocados consumed in the U.S. is grown in Michoacán in particular. Even if you're outside of the U.S., it's roughly half, maybe a little bit lower now, but roughly half of the world's avocados are grown in the state of Michoacán in Mexico.
Okay, so this huge spike in demand from this place that seemed to be the ideal spot for growing avocados must have been good for Michoacán's economy. Why has it been catastrophic over time for the region's environment?
Yeah, it's right. It's a combination of things where this is a state, Michoacán is a state, when it was, I think, sort of when it's commonly been in the international news, it's been known as a cartel hotspot. It's La Familia Michoacana is a very infamous cartel in Mexico, deeply involved with the methamphetamine trade, and that there's a reason for that. It's because it's a state that's been sort of marred by really aggressive poverty, and there are a ton of immigrants from Michoacán in places like the U.S. and all over. So it's not a place where there's been a lot of economic opportunity, and the avocado trade, in one sense, has been a real boon to the economy because it's an expensive food. It sells for a high price, and it's more remunerative than, say, growing limes or growing berries or some of the other sort of smaller agricultural activity that goes on out there. And so it's brought some wealth to the region that nothing outside of the drug trade really has brought. The downside, of course, is that with such a water-intensive industry, and the the comparison I think that's sort of most jarring here is that a pound of avocados requires as much water as a pound of almonds, which is what we think of as the most excessively water-intensive crop. The climatological effects, the effect on the hydrological cycle in this area, the deforestation. We can run down the list, but like the effects on the ecology of this area have been incredibly drastic.
Yeah, I do want to make sure folks understand this because it's terrifying and also fascinating. Land has been rapidly cleared of the native pines that grow in Michoacán by people who want to cash in on the avocado rush. These changes, of course, are sapping groundwater. That makes sense. But changing the vegetation grown there has also changed the weather in Michoacán, right? What has happened to the rainy season there?
Right, which is yeah, it's incredible to see these changes in such a short period of time as well. But the sort of large scale removal of native pine forests, which have are very, very different than avocado trees and avocado groves. The root structures are different. And even the way the aerosols that come off the pine needles interact with the with clouds and precipitation are very, very different. And so this area, which is known for its exceptional rainfall totals every year, has already seen the rainy season shrink from 6 months to 3 months, which is a huge change. The amount of groundwater that has been drained to sate these avocado orchards has been so substantial that the area is seeing regular seismic activity because of because of the draining of that groundwater. Thousands of seismic events in just a handful of months, which never happened before. There are giant sinkholes popping up all the time because of this, and so it's just a profound change to the landscape, to the rainy season, to the amount of to the water cycle generally.
Okay, and I want to talk more about the cartel involvement. I mean, people hear cartel and we think drugs, but I guess people form these criminal syndicates to control pretty much any valuable commodities. How have avocados become caught up in this system? Is it just easier, I guess, to control avocados and not have to worry about the feds seizing your shipment?
Yeah, it's exactly the right way of putting it. It's sort of nebulous, right? Because cartels are shorthand for a lot of things, and I think when cartels are invoked, it oftentimes sort of papers over some more nuance and complexity as to what's going on. But in this case, it's that there's cartels are a business formation, and they're one that makes a lot of money, generally speaking. And oftentimes they're involved in illicit trade, like the drug trade, but also they're very, very frequently looking for legitimate trades to get into that they might make money on. And so obviously avocados are not an illicit trade, but they are a remunerative trade. And so there has been in recent years a ton a, an incredible sort of uptick in violence as the cartels have tried to move in more and more on this trade. And sort of, invest in it and control the export. And, that's led to just some horrific outcomes. There was an incident in 2019 in Michoacán where 19 people were killed in a very public manner, and their bodies were disposed in, but they were both piled under this overpass and hanging from a bridge. It was all part of a showdown over controlling the avocado trade. And even the, even the USDA exporters who are there, who verify the fruit's quality for export back to the US, have been carjacked, have had death threats. It's one of these things where often, it makes a lot of sense in one way that, where there's money to be made, of course the money-making organizations that are nearby would like to be involved. And that's what we've seen a lot, especially of late.
All these conflicts, Alexander, are no less bloody than the ones between cartels looking to control the drug trade and push out competitors. So here's where we come to the center of your story, this small indigenous community called Cheran. What happened in Cheran 12 years ago?
It's a town of 20,000, small, largely indigenous Purépecha community, and they in 2011 were experiencing some of the, this is sort of classic cocktail of municipal corruption, environmental degradation. There was basically a tie-in between the mayor of the town and a local cartel group that had been engaged in some illicit logging in the mountains above the town. And this has gone on for a while. And at a certain point, the logging operation got very close to the spring, which provides all the fresh water for the town. And at this point, the frustration over that, you know, that corruption and the sort of concern about the threats to the livelihood of the town resulted in this massive uprising where basically the townspeople took these loggers hostage. They torched the trucks that they had come in on. They and then eventually actually locked down the town. They expelled not only the mayor, but the police force and shut it down. And actually over a handful of months, rewrote the entire governmental charter of the town and restructured it in a way that political parties were outlawed. They sort of redrew the constitution to minimize the vulnerability to corruption. And then they made this incredible environmental commitment that one, that avocados would be outlawed, two, that the forest would be, you know, guarded in an extreme and militant manner. And then third, of course, they chartered this militia to patrol that and to enforce these environmental commitments across the board.
Were you able to learn how the uprising was planned and carried out?
Yeah, the lore, this is there are these amazing murals and all this sort of public art dedicated to this event when it happened in 2011. It's the way it's talked about there is it was almost spontaneous, that there obviously were conversations about what was going on. There was concern, grave concern about, you know, the threats to the well-being of the town. And, you know, concerns about municipal corruption are sort of as old as time. But the day in question when this really broke seemed like effectively it was almost a spontaneous uprising, that there was just so much agitation and frustration over what was happening that one day it was just they just had to act. And it started early in the morning and then sort of proceeded from there, and the sort of revolutionary wheels began to turn and resulted in this really interesting sort of civic experiment in radical environmentalism and self-governance.
Yeah, lest this sound like some postmodern hippie commune, we should be clear. Chiran's current leaders are trying to protect the environment, but they are also trying to hold the line against degradation using militants.
Right. And because, of course, the cartel's close involvement with avocado growing as an enterprise, this is not like, it's not the sort of thing where it's negotiated in meeting rooms and in legislatures. This is the sort of thing where it's really like a war zone in a lot of ways. Like, this is frontline sort of oftentimes very violent contestation, and you know, this, it takes a lot of different forms, but all around Chiran now, on all sides, you can see avocado groves have basically been planted right up to the town line, and there are frequent fires that are set by growers to try to clear out the remaining pine forest in these adjacent towns, and so the threat of wildfire is extreme. The threat of armed growers who are backed by cartels is substantial. And there are even stories I heard while I was there about drone bombings of fields. They would fly over drones and drop explosive devices to try to clear out more land for planting orchards. So it's not definitely not on the level of like a kumbaya situation. It's more on the level of like an insurgency.
So you went down there to visit in the course of reporting this story, and your experience sounds not dissimilar to that of war correspondents I've interviewed.
Yeah. I think you definitely, in a lot of ways, yes, I think it's, the amount of weaponry in particular, and the sense of paranoia, the sort of, you know, latent fear about any sort of outside or any sort of confrontation can go any which way. Obviously, I think there's a lot of good reason to feel like that. And yeah, certainly that's how it felt to me as well.
So what kinds of precautions did they take when you just came into town as a reporter? They knew you were coming, but they didn't exactly roll out the red carpet.
Right, right. So I was traveling with a Mexican journalist who had been there a number of years prior, working on a story about the uprising when it first happened. And we called ahead, we cleared our visit. We actually had lined up interviews with, you know, the members of the town council, the governing body, really went to great lengths to make sure everything was above board and settled. And despite all that, you know, many weeks, months in advance, even, and despite that, when we rolled up, actually, we hit the checkpoint, which is a heavily armed and guarded checkpoint right on the highway. And their cell service was out that day. I guess one of the cell towers had been knocked out in the storm. And so we were unable to call our envoy. And for that reason, they were not going to let us in. It was not a come on in, see if you can figure it out when you get here. It was, the skepticism was very, very high. It took a lot of negotiation just to get across the checkpoint into the town. So, and that sort of mindset and mentality was sort of consistent throughout.
Help me understand how this all works in conjunction with the existing governments. I mean, Mexico has local, state, and federal government, just like the United States. Its constitution does have provisions for indigenous nations to apply for self-rule. What's happening in Cheran seems a little bit different than just like a city saying we're going to make our own rules.
Right, absolutely. The interesting thing about the Mexican Constitution is, as you mentioned, that provision that allows for indigenous groups to basically to secede and establish their own autonomous governing organizations, and with that they also receive usable funding, so federal and state funding to fund those operations. And so Cheran turned to this as basically a way for them to establish this project as a legitimate one. And the Mexican Supreme Court, after a handful of years, did find it to be a legitimate instance of this, given that, you know, that the Purépecha community there has been there for so long. There's obviously this continuity of language and cultural practice and all this stuff. And that's really how they were able to set this up. And interestingly, it's become a model for other towns in the area as well. So it's something that has both been deemed legitimate by the Mexican federal government, but also something that has been replicated by other places as well.
Some of those other places have attempted to copy this model and not had quite the same results. Talk about that.
Yeah, so there's this very interesting moment in Mexican politics generally, right around the time of this uprising in 2011, which was not initially really even about avocados. It was really just about cartel violence and corruption. So after this happened, there was this moment where there was I don't want to make it too sound more than it was, but it was a substantial trend where there was these groups called autodefensa groups that were established, which is basically self-policing within towns. And then there were also a handful of groups that tried to copy the Cheran model exactly, where it was not just arming a bunch of people in the town and letting them do their own policing to sort of keep cartels or corrupt cops or corrupt politicians away. This was a whole sort of state-based revolutionary sort of enterprise to establish those environmental commitments, to set up this new governing structure, to outlaw political parties, to do all of this. So you have both of those kind of simultaneously happening at once. And on one side, the autodefensa movement became something that was basically hijacked by cartels in various ways very quickly. And then there, on the other side, you had some successful ones as well. So there are 26 towns now that have copied the Cheran model, and they're smaller than Cheran, but they're abiding by the same basic principles, and they've been very successful. So it's sort of an interesting story where it goes in two directions. And the one that sort of breaks bad, breaks really bad in a lot of ways.
Why outlaw political parties?
It's I think that they, you know, it's the sort of political lineage that this group sort of sees itself as part of is really fascinating. And there's a ton of reference to the Zapatistas, which is obviously a revolutionary group in Mexico in the early 20th century down in Chiapas. And so they, sort of the philosophy of governance sort of came in part from that. It came in part from a traditional Purépecha political organization as well. And I think that between the two of those things, they sort of felt like that was one of the keys to forestalling corruption in the area. And it's a not a Leninist approach exactly, but it's an interesting school of thought. And that's something that there I think is a really great question for like anthropologists and sociologists as well as is sort of why or how this has been successful, because it's something that is very different, I think, from the sort of some of the more, Marxist revolutionary projects that I think are more commonplace.
Alexander, would you call the governance of Chiran a democracy? How would you characterize the form of governance they have?
Yeah, absolutely. So they have it's a really interesting democratic structure too. So they have elections basically every 3 years, and so not only is the government turnover every 3 years, but also all the public sector jobs turn over every 3 years. The one exception being the Ronda, which is the armed sort of military police force that does both policing and the sort of environmental protection work. Those jobs don't turn over, but everything else turns over every 3 years. And so the governing council is elected at that pace. And there are 12 representatives who are elected for a term. There are minimum thresholds for women in all of these roles, so the council can never be more than or never have more than two-thirds male representation. So, or yeah, I think they have to have at least four women on the council at any given time. So there, it's very democratic, but there are also these sort of other restraints in place, other policies that sort of buttress that, and I don't think I'm as I remember it, I don't think there's any sequential terms being served. So neither is there really a head of the council. There's a the 12 members are all sort of equally endowed with voting power, and that's sort of the structure they arrived upon, and has now been, it's now into its fourth term. So they 12 years on have sort of stuck with this and been able to reproduce it multiple times over.
So this paramilitary group, the Ronda, that is responsible for enforcing the law, how does it respond if they happen to catch somebody trying to grow an outlawed avocado tree or conducting illegal logging or burning or something else that's proscribed?
It's swift and severe, the punishment. As I was told, it's if anyone is seen to be planting a single avocado tree, and this is, I should say, this is out in the mountains here. It's very forested mountains. There's a town, but the surrounding region is not. There's not a lot of infrastructure, so it's sort of place where you could, in theory, sort of plant a few trees, and no one would be any the wiser. But if you're found to have planted an avocado tree, they'll send the armed military group they'll cut down the tree, they'll dig up the stump, they'll throw it in the back of a truck and haul it away, basically no questions asked. And then you have to go before the council to face a penalty for doing so. That could be a financial penalty or anything else. But if you're found to be doing it multiple times, and that's illegal logging or planting avocado trees, which is I think it's sort of the arch concern. You can even have your land requisitioned by the council. So it's not something that's taken lightly. If you're found to be in violation of this repeatedly, you can end up having your land taken back by the state in short order.
So it's really remarkable. It's not just that they want to prevent like commercial production of avocados. If somebody's abuelita wants a tree for her personal use in the backyard, she might lose her land.
Yeah, I think that they're so I didn't see any. I heard that there are maybe a handful of trees that are still like that, basically for personal use that have that were planted before the uprising in 2011 that they've allowed to continue, or they, you know, they haven't chopped down. But yeah, no more than that. And yeah, these are not equivocal commitments. So it's across the board.
Do the people who live there recognize how peculiar this might sound to outsiders?
I think so. I think you know, it's interesting because it's a success story in many ways, and the both on the level of just like the amount of crime is much lower, and the amount of violence is much lower than other parts of Michoacán. Michoacán is an incredibly dangerous state, routinely ranked as the most dangerous in Mexico. If you look at, you know, the list of cities with the highest murder rates year over year, you'll see three separate cities from Michoacán in the top 50, pretty much every year. And Tehran is a real exception to that, and I think that that is notable. And then the environmental commitments as well, I think, are certainly realized, are certainly known to be specific and in particular to this area, especially because, you know, this little town is wedged in right in the middle of this territory. It's only 100 miles where all these avocados are grown. The whole industry is really crammed into a very, very small stretch, and you know, right in the middle of it is this one town that is in true rejection of that entire operation.
Alexander, have the cartels mostly left Cheran to its own fate, or does the cartel movement remain a risk to this kind of militant environmentalism that has taken hold there?
I think it's a very much a, it's a very real risk, and it's something that is a concern, I think, on a daily basis. While I was there, they were building a third checkpoint. There are currently two checkpoints that sort of, you know, keep the flow of traffic highly monitored from outside, you know, outside vehicles, outside entities. They were building a third one while I was there, so obviously there was a concern about ratcheting up the surveillance in some sense. And then just on a year-to-year basis, the encroachment of the industry has been is very, very obvious. And you know, while I was out there, I went out with the with a deployment of armed guards, and we went out to the boundary of the territory. And everywhere you go, you can see. I mean, it's right up to the line. There are newly deforested areas. There are recently burnt down areas. There are places that have just seen saplings planted in small trees, and it's a threat from everywhere. And then even while I was there was a confrontation with loggers that happened on the opposite side of town, where a neighboring town was trying to cut down some pine trees that they the guard, you know, the armed guard thought was actually part of Chiron's territory. And so, you know, that was all just in a couple of days. So I think these concerns are pretty much constant.
What is the town doing to promote reforestation of the lands it does control that had once been cleared for avocado production?
They've actually chartered a pretty incredible, you know, obviously I think that you know, the sort of environmental militarism aspect of this is fascinating, but the sort of civic project side of it is really astounding as well. And they've just in the course of a handful of years have established this amazing recycling program that's known to be one of the best in Mexico. They have this water filtration system that's sort of revered as being very, very advanced. But I think the sort of cornerstone is this reforestation program, which was really remarkable to see in action. So they, you know, are nestled in the middle of pine forest, of native pine forest, and in the course of trying basically to sort of undo the effects of deforestation, they have started breeding these native pine trees. There are three separate types of native pine from the area, and then a fourth type that's non-native, but that does really well in the area. And so they have a massive growing operation, a nursery that's working all year round, basically breeding from seeds to saplings to larger trees. And it's, again, it's something that's gotten national attention. So you know, students who study forestry will go and study there for months at a time. And they've managed to to do a really impressive job of reforestation. So what I was told was that the overwhelming majority of the deforested area has actually been reforested in a decade. So they've planted a ton of trees, and they also sell those saplings to landscapers, to all sorts of interested groups as well. So they both are making a sort of they're making money off this operation, but it's also part of a huge environmental reforestation program that has also been really successful.
In this country, many people link environmental activism with more privileged communities. And I will hasten to add that this has never been entirely accurate. It's just the perception because of like who gets on TV and who has the money to print up posters or whatever. But this is a really interesting case because I don't think Chetan is that, right? This is not some like vastly independently wealthy city with its own university and whatever. These are just regular working people who have made these changes happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is right. There's no secret endowment behind this that is powering the whole operation. It's really a very, very modest community. The stuff that they make money on, that they sustain themselves on, is they sell sap from the pine tree. Obviously, they sell these pine sprouts that they make money off of that. They sell sap from some of the pine trees, which can be used in electronics and paint thinner, and there are various uses for it. And they have a mill where they'll process fallen or diseased trees into 2x4s, and they sell wood pallets from that. But this is not right. This is not something where they have the privilege of being exceptionally wealthy based on some other industry or some other alliance. This is a community that basically decided to forego substantial riches, right, to live in a different way that they decided was both safer and more sustainable. And the wealth that's been created from the avocado industry is all around them. It's you go to these bigger cities and towns in the area where there is a presence, and you can see fancy cars and nice hotel rooms, and yet none of that really exists in Chetan.
Yeah, so that's my follow-up question. Is there constant tension as people, it sounds like they're able to make a decent living for people in the community with these alternative industries, but they're not taking in the easy money their neighbors are. Do the people who have put this movement into motion constantly have to kind of make the case for why this is worth continuing to do?
I think to some degree, yes. I think that there is, there's a sort of constant affirmation of the program, of the project, which I think is crucial to sustaining it. But I think also that, in the surrounding regions, the places where avocados are grown, there's a lot of evidence too of the risk that involves, and they're obviously something of a it's sort of referred to as a green gold rush because the amount of money that's made in selling avocados, but it's also a very, very tumultuous sector, and I think that there are a lot of elements of that that are clear to people as well, that there's a precariousness to cash crop industry as well, and so I think those things combined, both the safety, the environmental sustainability, and then also sort of what the alternative looks like, I think all sort of play into keeping this program going.
Is there a lot of movement, do you know, into and out of the community? Like maybe some people just don't want to live under these rules, and so they pick up and go, and maybe other people are attracted to what they've built in Chetan.
Yeah, well, I think in Michoacán generally there's a ton of migration. It's a place that's really known for that, and so I think that's part of it as well. I nowhere in my reporting did I hear about a sort of mass exodus because of the desire to make money in the avocado trade, or any sort of infighting or sort of a secessionist interest within the confines of Chetan. But in terms of people leaving and migrating out of Michoacán generally, that's a very, very common story.
All right, Alexander, we've come to the place in this conversation where we have to ask uncomfortable questions. First of all, is it possible to sustainably grow avocados at the scale we demand them?
I think that's a question that we need to be asking. If you look at the production sort of globally in this moment, there is a lot of evidence that no, it's just not possible. The core sort of sector in the industry in the United States is in San Diego County. Recent years, obviously, California has been through many drought cycles that are, you know, increasingly severe and sustained. But in recent years in particular, that crop has totally bottomed out. I mean, they're able to grow the fewest avocados, I think, in the last 25 years was last year's crop. So it looks not sustainable in California. It probably was never sustainable there, given, you know, the water needs and everything else. The other area that grows a lot of avocados is in Chile, and they've had a very similar experience where the avocado growing region there immediately was suffering from acute water shortages, acute water problems, and then massive wildfire came through and scorched the whole area. And now there's a lot of doubt as to whether or not that industry can bounce back there, if there's even a place for it. And so, looking at the Western Hemisphere, the only other major productive site is here in Michoacán. Is that enough to sustain a global appetite for avocados that grows at the rate it's been growing the last handful of years? I would have to suspect that the answer to that is no.
So your piece was the first time I had ever heard about the environmental implications of the avocado business. Had you known about this before? Why have we not heard that there might be some moral and environmental consequences to our appetite for these things?
I think it's a combination of factors. One is that this is a relatively novel fruit in a lot of ways. I mean, this is not something that's been, you know, at scale in fast food restaurants across the country, places like Subway and Chipotle, like really the largest fast food giants in the U.S. nowadays, and, you know, the sort of brunch staple, the avocado oil, right? There's just a lot of this stuff is fairly new. So I think that the speed at which these sort of trends develop and the impact of them, the way that they're felt, is just such that it takes a little while to really see what the impact is going to be, is one thing. But the other thing is that, you know, this is the success of the avocado is really just a fantastic success of the advertising industry, which is really behind its rise. And I think they've done a really great job of positioning it in supermarkets and in diet trends as a superfood, you know, all over Instagram and social media, as this sort of like cutesy and anodyne sort of fruit with these incredible health benefits and all this stuff. But none of that happened by accident, nor did it happen naturally. All of that was part of a very, very considered, very expensive and prolonged advertising campaign that was put together by some of the most powerful advertising agencies in the world. When you have those sorts of forces doing, you know, brand and image management, it's often hard to get a dissenting story out there.
And of course, as with a lot of problematic commodities, I mean, we can certainly choose to stop patronizing this industry, but that has consequences for human lives as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. It's right. There are a lot of people who depend on this industry. And, there are obviously agricultural giants that make a ton of money off of this, who are, you know, transnational, international groups and publicly traded. But there are also, you know, there are also middle class farmers and the like who do better on this than they would do on anything else. So it's sort of like one of those conundrums of global trade, is that it sort of the problems that it causes also, you know, are there are also benefits as well, and it's one of those thorny questions about how exactly to contend with that reality on a sort of broad basis.
So what should we think about when we see avocado, you know, as a menu item, or we're passing by a display of beautiful fruits in the grocery store? How can we make decisions about when to pass them up and when to purchase?
It's, you know, I don't have a prescription for that. And I wish I did. Obviously it's something that, that I think about as well as, you know, as a shopper and an eater. And I, you know, I love the taste of avocados and I, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, I think that's a question for, I think it's a good question to ask yourself. I think it's, something that's relevant for a lot of things, even beyond avocados. Of course, you know, there are plenty of sectors that are marred by illegal activity that are extractive and exploitative in ways. And I think it's just, you know, it's good at the very least to sort of be aware of those things and sort of know sort of the choice that you're making, at least when you do make it.
Journalist Alexander Salmon is a contributor to Harper's Magazine, which published his article, Forbidden Fruit. Alexander, this has been such an interesting story, and I really appreciate you sharing your reporting on this.
Hey, thanks so much, Chris. I'm so happy to be here.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe, or just go to our website and listen at will. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.